I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Everyone, and welcome to minute 74 of season 6 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Richard Durham of Ghibli Minute. Welcome back to the show, Richard.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
I'm going to see the world, and I'm going to build things. So, minute 74 begins with George continuing to pine over everything that's been going on for the last, 6 or 7 years in his mind. And
yeah, this is like a weird, this voiceover.
Yeah.
It's like a singular moment. It's like a weird cinematic device that we don't see anywhere else in the film. So it kind of stood out to me. When I was watching the film, I sat down to watch the whole thing, and then stand out in this minute. So it's I don't know. It's a weird. It seems like there.
It's a way of doing flashbacks without having to do it visually. It's letting us see.
Kind of weird because so much of the movie is a flashback, right? At least like the. I mean, we're kind of in the middle of a flashback, an extended flashback right now. So it's kind of like kind of a nested kind of flashback, if you will. So maybe they kind of had to use a different kind of device to do
that. Okay, I mean, I have thoughts as to why they did that. I think that part of it is to show George's life as it is right now. I mean, this is not an extravagant bedroom. You know, he's not living a lavish style or anything like that. And he's thinking back once again to all of his plans and dreams, and also thinking, you know, about how much agreeing with Potter or taking Potter's deal might have let him fulfill those dreams. So to give it to us, to visually see where he's living now, by listening to his dreams or his thoughts on his dreams helps see the contrast between the two.
The contrast, yeah.
Because it really sense. Is, you could say it's the difference between heaven and earth. You know, they're so far apart. You know, George, for this entire movie, every time he talks about it, George has these grandiose dreams, but he never gets to fulfill any of them because in reality, because his reality is him walking around in the Greenville house. That's his reality. But what he hasn't come to realize yet is that this is his actual dream. You know, this is what he really wants. He just doesn't know how to express it. You know, in his mind, he thinks he wants something else. You know, that's my interpretation of it.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the other, at the very beginning of the film, we hear prayers, which is kind of another kind of voiceover. And we don't see like those characters speaking. So we don't know if they're like, if that's internal dialogue or if they're like, you know, in their, we only see like the outside of the buildings that they're in. So we don't know if they're sitting in their, you know, over their beds, actually speaking those words out loud, or if it's internal dialogue.
Right. I mean, I've always imagined that they are sitting there, you know, praying over their beds. That's my interpretation as to what it is. Not just that these people having thoughts; they're actually verbalizing their dreams and or their wishes or good wishes for George. You Which it's really interesting because if for people who don't know this movie as well as people like you and I do, you don't recognize all the voices. But for someone who knows the movie, you're like, oh, that's Mr. Gower. Oh, that's
I mean, it helps that they have, they have their names on the signs in front of
Okay, that's
the
fine too, but I'm saying even without that, if you know the voices, you can really tell it. So, it sort of makes sense.
But this, I mean, this with these kinds of voiceovers, it always, I don't know why my voice always go, my mind always goes back to like David Lynch's Dune, where that kind of like voiceover representing somebody's inner thoughts was just kind of like overdone, like they had that dial like turned up to 11. And so, I mean, it's kind of something that is really more effective when it's used sparingly. And like as I said, this is the only time really that that happens in this movie. So it kind of stands out that you're actually kind of clued into somebody's thoughts without them like speaking a line of dialogue or like having it being, acted out visually.
Right. And I think it's very effective that way.
Yeah.
Because
I mean,
I think
it's a,
it does give us a clearer idea as to what George's dilemma is. He wants everything to be perfect for Mary and for his life, but he doesn't realize that it already is.
and it's also, when this kind of effect is used, it's like adds to the performance. Because like whatever, that character or that actor is doing physically, like visually on the screen, your interpretation of that could change based on whatever sounds they put on top of that, right? It's
Right.
like a little bit related to the what the Kuleshov effect that's like used that if you show like a blank face, depending on what the next shot is or the previous shot is, you interpret that blank face as like being happy or sad. It's like what
Right.
like when George what George Lucas told, Mark, don't have too big a reaction to like you're seeing your uncle and aunt. It's burned corpses, right? We don't see Luke like tearing up or crying out. We just like see him kind of turning away. But we add the emotion based on the next shot. So it's kind of similar to that. It's like if you remove this voiceover, would you have the same reaction or the same emotional impact to whatever Jimmy Stewart is like doing physically or visually in the scene?
Right. Well, I just want to, interrupt you for a second here because, the example you just brought from Star Wars brings us back to what we were talking about on Monday. So, I mean, when Luke sees the burnt bodies of Owen and Beru, his first thoughts are is, yes, I don't need to work another season here. So
There's nothing from here for me
that's
here
right.
now.
I don't need to stay here. I
You
can go.
don't think George Bailey would react the same if he saw like the building alone in flames?
I think he would. He would be the same way. He'd be like, okay, I can move on.
Well, he
There you
did.
go.
Well, he did see his dad. I mean, his dad had a stroke, so he kind of went through the same thing where the people, and he stepped in. But I guess
No, but again, it was the
the
figurehead
farm
that was
wasn't burned
missing,
down.
but not the building. He
Yeah,
knew that
that's right.
the building and the business needed to continue.
Yeah.
Which goes back to what we were talking about, months ago when we were talking about the decision after 3 months of mourning, where George is getting ready to leave. Who did George really think is going to take over?
Yeah, Billy? Really?
Exactly. Like, what other options are there? You'd think that he would have agreed with Potter. Okay, just close it down. There you go. I'm on my way to college. Don't need that anymore. All right. So, minute 74 begins with George still thinking about everything that Potter said to him and ends with George wondering big things for Mary. This entire, as we've talked about for the last since this episode began 10 minutes ago, we've been talking about the use of, the thoughts of everything that's going through George's mind. And we hear first Potter's voice saying maybe Europe once in a while, and then it jumps us back to George and Mary's first date together, if you want to call it that, where he goes, "I know what I'm going to do tomorrow, and the next day, and the next year, and the year after that. I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world, and I'm going to build things. I'm going to build airfields. I'm going to build skyscrapers 100 stories high. I'm going to build a bridge a mile long. What is it you want, Mary? What do you want? The moon? If you do, just say the word, and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull her down to you." And while we're listening to everything going on in his mind, we see George walk around the room. He's which gives us an idea of what type of lifestyle the two of them are having. So, I mean, yesterday we talked about, first of all, that we saw one tie on the back, but today you can actually see that there are three.
Yeah, there are three ties, yeah.
Right. So he's got a total of four ties, which you'd think that if he was doing that, he should already, splurge and go with the five ties, so that he has different tie for every day of the week.
For every day of the week. Yeah, exactly.
That's right. I mean, two seasons ago, we talked about the fact that Sally had underwear for every day of the week. So why shouldn't George have, a tie for every day of the week? That would make sense too.
Maybe he's got a bow tie or something for that, something festive for Friday.
There you go. Maybe.
A bolo.
It's
Did they
definitely
wear
very possible.
bolos in 1936?
It's anything is possible. But as we look around the room, you see that it's a very simplistic, simplistically decorated room. It even looks as if there's like water damage on the side of the wall. Like when he's standing and looking in the mirrors in front of him, and we can see on the left-hand side
Yeah.
the thing with George lassoing the moon. If you can see that the 22nd mark, if you look to the
Yeah,
left, to the
to the
right-hand
right.
side, to the right, it looks like that might be like water damage or something like that in the room.
Yeah, right next to the window. Yeah. Actually, on both sides of the window, if you back out to like second 12, you can see it on the other side of the window as well.
Right. So again,
The same
it's
kind of
that's
stains.
right. That's right. So it's showing that they're making do with what they have, but he wants more for Mary, but he's still content with what he has.
You can see that the bed frame has paint is flaking off of the bed frame, so that's obviously a hand-me-down. You can see they have string tied up as I guess probably like a clothesline inside, and then here's your more light switch coverage. The lamp, which initially I thought was like a standing lamp. But the lamp over the bed, I think it's probably hanging from the ceiling at somehow. They got a long cord to turn the lamp on and off, which is so that you can easily turn it on and off while you're lying in bed, which is
Right.
very
So it's a
nice.
makeshift type of
Yeah.
cord. Wow, interesting. Or maybe it's a bell. Potter's secretary will show up when
Sure.
they ring the bell
Bert
or
and
alert.
Ernie, yeah.
But no, it's that is a great catch. I mean, I saw the string, and I just assumed that that was for like maybe a fan or something like that. But you're right; it is for the lamp. And George lies down on the bed, and then Mary just gets up really quickly as she starts singing. And obviously, what is she gonna sing? Because she knows that he's thinking about that night after they all fell in the pool. So obviously she's going to start singing, you know, Buffalo Gals, because, you know, besides the fact that that's their song, she knows he's thinking about that night. You know, they plan that really well.
Is that just something that's just like a recurring bit that they have, like between the two of them, where she just sings that like all the time, I bet.
Yeah. Right. So she sings it, and he comes over to her, and then, you know, he sits down on the bed, and she jumps up, and then they both say hi to each other. And, you know, we can see the clock behind him. So yes. We already know what time it is. Did you notice what time it is?
It's 12:25, isn't it?
That's right. So I highly doubt that he just is coming, that he's coming right now from
no, I don't think the bank is Potter's that crowded. Bank.
That's right.
at midnight.
Right. Yeah. But what it means is that he's been walking around for 8 or 9 hours. I mean, this is a long time to be mulling over this whole thing. Because let's
he missed dinner.
Where that's did he right.
have dinner.
That's right. I mean, let's.
Was he just working late?
Well, I don't
know.
Did he
go back to the office?
You think so? You think he went back to the office and then? My interpretation is that his meeting with Potter was at the end of the workday, because he can't leave the building alone. You know, so if Potter says, "I want to have a meeting with you," he says, "Okay, we close at 4. I'll be by you at 4:30." I don't know. You know, that's my interpretation of it. And possibly the bank is still open, you know, on that particular day. So that's why, you know, the people are hustling and bustling around in the background, stuff like that.
Right.
But now it's 12:30.
Transactions
right.
done before like, the closing time. Yeah.
That's right. So what the hell happens between, 4:30 and 12:30? So we're talking 8 hours. You know, it's like it reminds me of The Naked Gun, you know, where he's sitting in, where he starts going for a walk, and he ends up, you know, we hear Drebin's voice over of everything, you know, of how he's mulling over the case and whatever, and then you see that he's like in the somewhere in the Hollywood Hills, you know, and he's like on a cliff, and he looks around and he goes, "And how the hell did I get here?" Yeah, you know, he's asking all the questions about the case itself. You know, why would they do that, and why would they do this, and why is it, and how the hell did I get here, or where, or what the hell am I doing here, or something like that. You know, and that's the you know, maybe that's what happened. Maybe he was just in a daze, walking around for 8 hours.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, so we see elsewhere in the movie that he works late all the time. So. I would guess that's what she thought he was doing, at least.
Right.
Like she probably didn't have any questions about why he missed dinner. She probably just assumed that he was, but she might have called the building and loan and just asked, "Hey, is George there? Is he going to be home for dinner or what?" Or maybe assumed
he was. Do you think he would have told her that he has a meeting with Potter? Or do you think it was a spontaneous meeting?
I think my read is that it happened kind of like what you said, that Potter calls him in the middle of the day, says, "Hey, I want to meet." And George is like, "Look, I'm not at your beck and call. If you want to meet, happy to meet with you after my business concludes the day," right? So he goes over there like at the end of the day. Maybe not after they close, but after he's done most of his work. And I don't think he would have any reason to call home and say, "Hey, Potter wants to meet with me."
Right. It's just, okay, another day I'm staying late at the building and loan.
Yeah. So okay, that's he fair. Might have gone back to finish some things up, or he might have been wandering around, like you say. But again, it wouldn't, based on the doubts that he's having here, this is... I don't think he's had this conversation about it with her before. I don't think he called her after the meeting or anything. This is the
right,
because he's probably been walking around wondering what to say, right, in case she, you know, it comes up.
Well, he probably took his feet. He probably took off his shoes and was walking around in the grass.
Exactly. Went up to the falls.
There you go. Makes sense. And then he
turned. Long way up there. It's 10 miles.
That's right. Hey, it's possible that you know, it would take him 4 hours there and 4 hours back, you know.
There you go.
And then he says to her, Mary Hatch, why in the world? And that's how this minute ends. You know, I really enjoy this minute because it isn't giving us that much new verbally, but visually, it's telling us so much. I like it. I like the way they do this.
It's kind of summarizing his journey so far.
Yep.
Yeah, and kind of painting the picture of where he is right now.
Right. Correct. All right. So did you have anything else for this minute?
No, I didn't. I will say, you know, so we got our light switch week payoff, but I think tomorrow is, if I can have a little cliffhanger, tomorrow is the key to this entire movie.
Yes.
So I'm very lucky to have the minute tomorrow, because it is the keystone that unlocks everything in the movie.
All right. So everyone will have to
be here for that.
Hear that. That's right.
Wait for you, baby.
There you go. So every Thursday, we have a segment called Jimmy Stewart Thursday, where my guests will give their top five Jimmy Stewart performances. So, Richard, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Number five is, I believe, his first film role as, spoilers, it turns out to be the murderer in After the Thin Man. I'm a big fan of the Thin Man film series. And as I was going through those movies many years ago, and I was already a Jimmy Stewart fan, and I was delighted to find that this was his debut role as kind of, and he, you know, seems like a minor part, and then it turns out to be the villain. So that's a lot of fun. Number four. So I've seen a bunch of Jimmy Stewart, not a lot recently, but one movie that I did watch in the last couple weeks, so I put it on as number four, is The Shop Around the Corner.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know, which is supposedly the basis for
You've Got Mail.
You've Got Mail, yeah. But not sure that it's exactly the same plot, but it is a pretty good movie. It has the I can't think of, I don't know his name, but the guy who played the Wizard of Oz, the titular Wizard of Oz, Frank Morgan. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah. So he's really, Frank Morgan is actually really good at that. So that was a fun movie. Number three. It's kind of a toss-up.
No toss-ups allowed.
All right, so I didn't want to. This is very. The rest of the list is very Hitchcock-heavy, because I think that I really love that period of his career. So I will. I won't put Rope. I'll go with Anatomy of a Murder as number three. And number two, Rear Window. And Charles features Raymond Burr as playing against type as the murderer,
as the heavy,
as the heavy, yes. And then number one is Vertigo.
Wow, great movie. I'm actually surprised with you that you do not have It's a Wonderful Life on this list.
Yeah, probably.
Oops, I forgot.
Yeah, I had it in my Capra list, but I didn't have it here. I probably Yeah, that's probably an oversight, but I wanted to do stuff outside for this that's list. Good. I wanted to kind of do outside of this movie.
No problem. Yeah. That's allowed. No, it's just all week you've been talking about how much you love this movie and you love this performance. Whenever and we're talking about the best performances, really, and it's not
do
there.
Do you really love this movie, Richard? Yeah. Do you?
You know that you're talking to George Bailey, right? George Bailey?
Exactly.
All right. Okay, Richard, why don't you...
I do love his Hitchcock period, though. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that. All right, so Richard, you want to once again tell people where they can find you?
You can go to my website, dunhamrc.com, which has links to my two podcasts, Akira Minute and Ghibli Minute.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So I once again want to invite everyone to come back tomorrow so that you can hear Richard's take on why tomorrow's minute, the 75th minute of this movie, is the keystone of the movie. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.